I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 7 of the Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in East Nashville, Tennessee. I'm so glad you've chosen to join me once again as we take some deep dives with a cast of wonderful musicians, producers, and engineers that I've managed to track down and speak to about making music, records, and just doing what they do in their lives in music. Don't forget, there's a link to a playlist on Spotify and Apple Music with links to many of the songs we discuss on today's episode. You'll find links to those playlists in the show notes below or at our website. Meanwhile, the show continues to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription, which is a monthly payment of your choice. And when you sign up for Patreon, you get an ad-free version of the show to listen to, as well as getting entered to win a cunning prize pack from our sponsors at the end of the season. Or if you're tight for dough and you still want to help out, you can subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just by spreading the word, sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, a huge thanks to the sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know I sent you. They are Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra 1964, The Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resophonic Guitars, and The Hen House Hang. All right, thanks so much to you for tuning in, and let's get down to it. Howdy, music nerds, and welcome back to the show. This is episode number 145, and my guest today is an incredible songwriter and singer and banjo player, originally from Montreal, but now living in New York, Kaya Cater. So thanks for tuning in today. It's nice to get a chance to hang with you all. My apologies for skipping a week there last week. So I was in Vancouver for the folk festival, and it was really nuts. And I just didn't have time to get the episode out until after I was back and settled back into my real life. It was a pretty stellar weekend, though. I got to play my own music, which was fun, with my band. I got to play guitar for the mighty Joe Henry. Have you heard his episode from season one? Go have a listen to that. I got to back up a bunch of great artists on a gospel stage, which was really fun. I got to play guitar for Joaquin Cooter, and he played drums for me. And then I organized this big old show where 10 different artists did songs by the Grateful Dead. I had to arrange all the music for that and work with the artists to do the songs the way that they wanted to do them. So that's actually a show I do every year in Vancouver in the fall. It's what I do is I somewhat randomly pick an album, and we bring in guests, and we reinterpret the album with a full band and each guest doing one song. It's a lot of work. It's a ton of fun. We've done it about 10 times now. And last year we did American Beauty by the Grateful Dead. And it just so happened that this year the folk festival wanted us to redo a scaled down version of that show for the festival. So I said yes, and that's how that came to be. Anyway, we're doing that show again in October in Vancouver, and this year we're going to tackle Highway 61 Revisited by a little-known songwriter named Bob Dylan. Should be a riot. Come and see the show if you're around Vancouver or even Western Canada. All the details for tickets are up now on my website, stevedawson.ca. Otherwise, it's back to work here on a bunch of new records. Some really exciting projects are coming through, and I've got lots of stuff coming up here. I've also been watching this whole SAG-ACTRA strike thing going on, where actors and writers are on strike to get fairly compensated, mostly for streaming. And, you know, my hat goes off to them and hope the best for them to negotiate a better deal. It also makes me really sad to think that this is exactly what happened to the music industry about 7 or 8 years ago. And we basically did nothing except roll over and let the streaming services pay us nothing for our music. It's kind of a sad situation, and everyone's aware of it. We don't need to get into a big thing here and now about it, But it's really interesting to see the difference between the two industries and see how one that has more money and power can pull off these feats of complete cooperation between their members and work on, you know, getting paid fairly, where the music community just straight up couldn't find a way to get that done. It's so different and a little disturbing. So anyway, it's a little late to do much about that now, but here's hoping maybe they'll sort something out. So, you know, support your musicians, everybody. We got really screwed. And before we get going here, I would just like to shout out to a couple of people who were generous enough to support the show this week. So many thanks to Jim Pollard and Bill Nork. Thanks, guys. Couldn't do it without you. So on the show this week, we have Kaya Cater. I've always found Kaya's music really fascinating, and she's also been someone that I've seen grow as an artist from when she was super young to where she's at now. She's still super young, as a matter of fact, but she's less super young than she was when I first saw her quite a few years ago. She kind of grew up around folk festivals and events like Folk Alliance and things like that through her mom, who I also know. And basically just from being at and playing at festivals over the last 25 years of my life, I've run into them a fair chunk of times. Her mom was around mostly booking and managing artists, and I know her a bit. And then Kaya started showing up on the scene, I don't know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago or something. And in the last 7 or 8 years, she's put out some really incredible music. She's a really interesting banjo player and writes primarily on the banjo, but she does on other instruments as well. And she's well-versed in traditional banjo music and string bend and old-time music, which she studied in depth that you'll hear about at Davis and Elkins College in West Virginia. And also on her dad's side, she has a strong Grenadian connection, which is where he's from. She did some hefty research into his life and the music from that island, and that all comes out in a pretty incredible way on her album from 2018 called Grenades. So go have a listen to that, as well as the one before called Nine Pin. Both are really cool, creative albums. And she also has a brand new album that's stellar. I've heard it, but it's not out yet, and she's not exactly sure when it will be out. So we do talk about it a bit, but as of right now, it's not available. But do keep your eyes out for Kaya's new record coming out either late this year or maybe early next year. She will be out there touring a bunch, and I highly encourage you to go see her. She's great live and has a killer band as well. You can keep track of all that stuff and check out her dates at kayacater.com. So let's get down to it. Please enjoy my conversation with Kaya Cater. I wonder if we should maybe start by talking about that. Like, are you willing and able to talk about the new record? I know it's not coming out for a while, and this episode will probably come out before your record comes out. So maybe we'll keep that to a bit of a minimum. Tell me a bit about, I don't know what the record's called. So first of all, can you tell me what it's going to be called when it comes out?
Yes, it's going to be called Strange Medicine.
Okay. Yeah. In listening to all your work, you've got, this is your, I guess, like your fourth full length record now.
That's right. Yeah. Fourth. I had to think about it for a second.
Yeah. Don't we all?
Fourth full length. Yeah.
So I'm curious about how the process has evolved for you, like as far as approaching making records. I know the last record, Grenades, was like had a very specific focus, and there was like a sort of a pilgrimage, if you will, involved in kind of tracing your roots through your father's side of the family. Was this a totally different process for you as far as the creation and the writing goes? And the other part of this that I'm curious about, and we can open this, and it may be a bigger can of worms, is for a young artist like you, that's a big gap. Like, this is a 5-year gap in between mm-hmm. records. And I know you've been doing other stuff, and I know there was a worldwide pandemic in there. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that and whether there was more to it than that, or whether it was just like a combination of those things.
Yeah, sure. Great questions. So to answer the first one, this was quite a different process from Grenades. Just for listeners, I basically went back to my father's home country of Grenada in the Caribbean to write Grenades, which I put out in 2018. And my dad had been a refugee in Canada, and I'd sort of had this like distant relationship with the Caribbean. And so it was just a way to, I think, trace my roots a little bit. And I was in my mid-20s and feeling kind of unmoored. So it was a lot of traveling, a lot of researching. I put out that record with the Smithsonian Folkways, and so I got to go into their archives and look up a bunch of like really amazing Grenadian folk music that had been collected like through the 50s and 60s. So it was a lot of kind of like hopping around and putting pieces together. And I flew to Vancouver and interviewed my dad and put some of his voice on the record. So I felt like a little bit more of a sense of movement. And then, of course, when I was writing for Strange Medicine during the pandemic, I was just in one place. And so I had always had this romantic idea of like the artist goes and they write in a beautiful place and they must not have any distractions and, you know, very kind people make their meals. And, you know, and this was a thing where I really had to just push myself into a routine and just write every afternoon, even if I didn't feel that inspired. And so it felt a little bit more like hammering away at a geode and kind of mm-hmm. like, you know, that there's stuff in there, but you got to root through a lot of the kind of monotony of writing, the less romantic side of writing.
Totally. Is that something for you that do you have to like make yourself sit down and write? If you don't do it, you kind of like let that slide, or what's your process for like getting in and actually doing that kind of work?
Well, to speak to the second part of the question, I mean, you said 5 years is a big gap and you're completely right. And I think, you know, I'm turning 30 in September. So, and I put out Grenades when I was 25. So I think the latter half of my 20s was really kind of like learning how to form writing habits and learning uh-huh. that, you know, songwriting is a craft that you hone just like anything else. And I spent a lot of time sort of thinking that the muse would strike. And I was kind of an inefficient writer. And I lost a couple years to that, I think, just mm-hmm. not quite figuring out how to have a regular writing practice. And I still can recognize in myself that I'm a slow writer. I'm not the type who will come into the studio with 30 songs and narrow them down with the producer. It's like I'm writing as the record is happening. And as the record is happening, I'm getting inspired. So, yeah.
That's a really nerve-wracking idea.
Yeah.
That would be terrifying.
Yeah.
So will you go in? Do you go in to a project with like a couple songs?
Yeah.
Holy shit. Okay.
Yeah, and I really ride that line, right? But I find so far it's worked out. I don't know if it will keep working out, but I've found that that kind of pressure is nice, because I think without that pressure, I'm the type to sort of let things go or not really like be extra critical of everything and never bring anything to the table. And mm-hmm. so if it's like, no, you have a record to make, then I'm forced to bring things to the table that I personally don't think are ready. And you know, and a lot of the times that's a good thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
you're a deadline thriver.
I'm a deadline thriver for better and for worse.
That's cool though. So what about the Grenades record? Like, was that one as well that you actually started working on the recording of before you had all the material? That seems like a really fully formed concept, or maybe it wasn't fully formed when you started it. I don't know. Did you set out to make that record?
It was not fully formed when we okay. went into the studio. I had, I think, 7 songs. So I felt like I was over the threshold of like a good collection of songs that we could look at and say, okay, who are the musicians going to be tracking the beds? And it was enough to kind of get people in for a good chunk of time. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely, I was writing a couple songs as that was happening, too. And, I don't know. It's something that I guess is a habit now. And, you know, I'm pretty happy with a lot of the stuff that I write kind of in the middle of the recording process. It's different.
It's working for you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So here's something I'm always really curious about with different artists in your situation is like the writing while you're on the road situation. Do you do any of that? Like, you know, I spent a good couple of years on the road with JT and Ali with Birds of Chicago, and they're an interesting example of like, they don't do any of that. And, you know, they would go into an album project and they would like write all the songs 2 days before they went into the studio. And they would just sit down and do it and it would be done.
It's amazing.
Yeah. But, you know, while they're on the road, nothing. I'm like that as an artist, too. Like, I don't really, when I'm on the road, I find myself just like barely being able to hang on for dear life. So I don't even try. Where do you stand on that situation?
Very similar headspace to yours. I feel like, at least for me, the last however long I've been touring, probably since 2016, it's really just been, okay, how do I eat well today? How do I sleep well today? you know, how do I manage my emotions, you know, in a car full of other people managing their emotions? And I will do like a fair amount of journaling.
Okay. So there's little tidbits coming here.
There's little tidbits coming here and there. And I'll, if I kind of get a flash of inspiration, I just have a running notes app that'll like put something into and file it away for later. But yeah, I admire people who can write on the road because it feels like a very particular headspace that you need to get into.
Yeah, I do know people that do it really well. And they're like always just like they're up at 7 a.m. an hour before getting in the van or whatever. And they're writing and they're disciplined and they do it and they're just used to it. And it's not like a struggle for some of them. Whereas for a lot of people I know, too, it's a major struggle.
Yeah, I'm definitely like grabbing as much sleep as I can. If I have a choice between an hour of writing and an hour of sleeping, I'll always choose sleeping.
Taking the sleep. Yeah. The only time for me where I get like a creative spark on the road, I find, is in sound checks. Like that's the only time where I actually have time to like mess around and do things that I wouldn't normally do. And that's where ideas come to me. And that's where I end up making little notes and things like that. I don't know if sound checks are ever like that for you at all.
That's really cool. Yeah, sound checks are mostly a space for me where I'll play other people's music. Like I'll just play covers that I really like.
That's
and
cool.
People, you know, the band will just play along, and that's really fun. But yeah, I like that creativity strikes during sound check for you.
Yeah.
It's great.
It does, yeah. So let me ask you some nuts and bolts about the new record, which, yeah, we won't dwell on it too much, but I'll try and wait with this episode to get it as close. I think your album's coming out when, December? Is that what I saw?
Yeah, but it's getting pushed. It's getting pushed into 2024.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm in the middle of that right now. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll push this as far as I can, but let's talk a little bit about that. So was the process for actually making this record different? So to me, it sounds like on a lot of your previous recordings, you've gone in and it's kind of a band situation. What I really like about Grenades is like there's a palette of, you know, it's like steel, banjo, vocal, bass, and then minimal drums and that kind of thing. With the new record, it sounds a bit more orchestrated. Like there was more, you know, there's like woodwinds and other textures on there from the stuff that I've heard. And so I wondered if it was more of a, you know, like a studio kind of approach where you were doing a lot more overdubbing or anything, or was it kind of a live tracking setup, or how did you approach recording this time?
So I co-produced this album with a friend of mine, Joe Grass, who you probably know. Joe is, for anyone who's listening, he's an incredible musician, played for a long time with the Barr Brothers, Patrick Watson, just kind of like a man about town in Montreal. And I've known Joe for, gosh, like 20 years or something. And I've wanted to work with him for a long time. And the way that he works is he really likes to take his time if he can with recordings. So I was sort of expecting a situation like Grenades where I would write as much as I could. We'd kind of hire a core group, go in, track stuff, and then have beds. And the way that he wanted to approach it was to actually get as far as we could with demos. So sketch out big ideas, you know, for like a couple months beforehand. We ended up hiring orchestrators during the demo phase as well. And so we would send them the demos and then they would
put in their like MIDI orchestrations into it. And we did a lot of like approvals based on that, so that once we did get into the studio, a lot of the orchestration stuff was already ironed out. So we knew.
And the arrangements obviously were locked in at that point too, I guess.
Because, yeah, exactly. And the arrangements were done by Dominic Mecchi and Frankie Russo, who are New Yorkers, and they've done a lot of work like on Live From Here with Chris Thiele. So they've worked a lot with folk singers. And so that so we did a, like just a massive amount of pre-production. And it was kind of during that time that I would write, that I'd be like, okay, here's another song. And I was sending Joe songs every week. And then once we got into the studio, it had been about 6 months. And we decided to track with just me playing banjo and acoustic guitar and a drummer. Mm-hmm. And so the beds was just me and this drummer named Phil Melanson. And it was just all of us in the studio for about 5 days.
So just the two of you tracking like to a click?
Just the two of us. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you'd have to do it to a click too, right? Because of the orchestration.
Yeah. It was all to a click. Yeah. And like, again, like all the BPMs figured it out beforehand, you know, and actually we figured out a way to have some of the orchestrations from the demo piped in to our cans. So could kind of hear what was happening with the orchestration and adjust accordingly. And Phil on drums could do that too.
Does that cramp your style at all? Like, do you, when you play live, do you like to stretch things out a little bit and like be a little loose with stuff, or do you keep things pretty rigid as far as the structure goes?
I definitely like people to stretch. I really love playing with people with jazz backgrounds in live situations, because I think they have this comfort with improvisation that I find that I really admire. It's a skill set that I love and I learn a lot from. And so live, that's sort of been my approach, is to have these, you know, big spaces or kind of like look at someone and they know that they can do their thing and kind of have this like push and pull trust thing. And so, yeah, I think the creativity that came during the recording session was really with Phil, because I sort of knew what my parts were. And I think, like, dynamically, I definitely changed some things, but like Phil was coming in. He had done a couple demos for us, you know, way, way back. And he, you know, wouldn't remember what he had played. And so once he came in, it was like he was approaching the songs like in a new space again. And so it was basically just like days of like trying stuff. And that's something that's where the freedom came, because I feel like with Grenades, there was so much to get through that we really were pretty locked in for time. And so we were, you know, everyone had been rehearsed. We had a day of rehearsals prior to going in. And so I feel like with this album, there was a lot more time to stretch in those ways, but it was just this weird mix of being ridiculously prepared and then also having like a ton of space.
Do you go into those sessions like fully committed to your parts and your thing, and then you're just sort of waiting to see what happens with the other players, or in this case, the other player? Or are you kind of letting yourself twist and turn as you go as well?
I think it depends on the song. I would say, like, musically, I'm much more comfortable on the banjo because I've been playing the banjo for years and years. So with the banjo, with Phil and me and the banjo and drums especially, I feel like I was stretching and I was trying things, and that was incredibly fun. I think with the guitar, the acoustic guitar is like, it's newer to me. And so I do remember feeling like, okay, I really need to play these parts well. And I sort of need to practice them. Like, I just wasn't at that place yet where I could try things as much as I could on banjo. So it was a mix.
Is guitar something you've never recorded before?
No, I recorded it on Grenades. I recorded some guitar.
There's a bit of guitar in that. Okay. Yeah, I think the song Internet, am I right about that? That's like, is that guitar you're playing on that?
Yeah, so that's the other thing, is any of the finger picked stuff That's Joe.
Yeah. Oh,
mostly
okay.
because he's a guitar player. He's really great at that stuff. And so
Yeah.
I wrote them and I was like strumming them. And he would say, oh, I wonder what this would sound like if we just finger picked it, or if there was another kind of like pattern to it. So he was really adamant against playing guitar on this record at all.
Oh yeah.
You know, like,
you had to talk him
yeah,
into it.
There was like, he's like, there's not going to be any electric guitar. And I was like, okay, great. And so, yeah, any of the finger pick stuff, I was like, come on, Joe, like, just try something.
So would he have overdubbed that, or was he playing that live with you and the drummer?
So like, for example, on the internet, there were no drums on the internet. So he just played it in and I sang over it. But let me see, for things like Mechanics of the Mind, which is one that's kind of like picked, I actually tracked it in, strumming with the drummer. And then he ended up going in later and like doing the finger picking thing. Overdubbing it. So it was like a mix of stuff. Some stuff was live in the studio and some stuff wasn't.
And what about your vocals? Were you tracking those live as well with the drums, or was that all done after, or how did you approach that?
That was all done after, except one track where we really felt like we weren't getting it just with guitar and drums. Mm-hmm. And Phil was there, and like I said, we had time, and so basically Joe played guitar, I sang, we were in the same room, and Phil was in another room, and that we tracked all of that live off the floor.
On previous recording projects for you, are you like, it sounds to me like on earlier records, it's got more of a live feel where you're probably playing and singing at the same time. I don't know if that's what happened or not, but that's kind of how it comes across. Whereas on this one, it sounds like almost like the banjo often is in a different place, you know, like it feels like the banjo's in one plane and your vocals on another plane. And I would guess that they were tracked separately in that way. And it sounds like they probably were. Is that something that you were used to doing, or did you always kind of go in and like work on the vocal stuff as overdubs?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. Like all of Nine Pin was recorded live. Vocals and banjo, yep. Most of Grenades was recorded live. So yeah, this mm-hmm. was the first time that I had time and money basically to overdub. And I would say mixed reviews about that. I think there were elements of it that I really liked, like being able to focus in on lyrics and really execute them the way that I felt that they should be executed and to have time to do that. But there's also this other level, I think, of vocal overdubs that I'm sure you know, where the artist can sort of spin into a negative headspace because you have endless takes and because you have endless time. Sometimes it feels like there's like this kind of happy medium that you hit, which is, I think, this cross section of what you want and what you can do. And then it starts to crash. and so
I have a theory that's based around triangulation where if you're just doing one thing like singing and it's just, and that's all you're thinking about and that's all you're hearing and that's all you're playing, then that can be a problem. If there's two things that are happening, the same kind of problems arise. As soon as there's a third element in there, whether it's another player or a third player or whatever, there's so much that like gets smoothed out somehow in the process. So it's all, for me, like three is the magic number where that starts to go away. And you can like, you know, it's not like not necessarily that you're letting things slide. It's just that the microscope kind of goes away at that point, and you kind of like the flow is like a different process. I don't know. It's a little heady, I guess, but that's my theory.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And actually, they have that theory about pitch. So like if two stringed instruments are playing together, they'll compete for like pitch if they're slightly off from each other. But as soon as you stick a third instrument, all the pitch will totally regulate.
It's all good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's strange. Rule of threes.
Yeah. I find the three thing, like in particular with time too, like it's a, you know, whereas if you're overdubbing a guitar part and it's a little dodgy time-wise, you're just going to sit there and try and fix it. If it's two things, you're going to do the same. If it's three things, there's enough like compromise about where a beat is, you know, even if you're talking about like bluegrass music or something where they're going fast and furious. But as soon as there's a third element, it's just like all that stuff kind of like gets glued into place. And I don't know, three.
Three. It's a magic number.
Magic number.
Jinx.
So where did you make this record?
I made it at a studio called Mix Art in NDG, Notre Dame de Grasse, which is a neighborhood in the south end of Montreal. And I went in for one full week and then went back to New York. And then we did some edits and then we came back with the orchestras and we did a horns and woodwind session. And okay. And then I like recorded a couple overdub vocals. So it was two separate little chunks that we did.
So back to New York, are you living in New York part-time or something?
I am, yeah, sorry. I'm living in New York. I did not mention that.
Oh, yeah. Cool. So what part of New York do you live in?
I'm in South Brooklyn in Kensington.
Okay. I just pegged you for a Montrealer through and through, but I guess I missed the mark on that.
No, you didn't. I mean, I was born in Montreal. When I started writing the record, I was in Montreal. I always cycle back to Montreal.
So why did you move to New York? What was that all about?
Well, my partner is a bass player, and hence there's two basses.
Hence the basses.
Many basses. And he's American, and it was a lot easier for me to get an artist visa to move here than it is for him to get an artist visa to move to Canada.
And really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of bizarre. Canada's immigration policies are quite strict. So
weird. I would not have thought that.
Yeah. I feel like there's also this thing where I think like living in the States is pretty beneficial for my career. So, you know, of course it was for love, but also for for money.
Opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. For love and for money. And so like all coincided to working out that way.
Oh, that's cool. So are you there for an indefinite amount of time at this point? Or are you kind of picturing yourself going back to Montreal? Or is this like a semi-permanent thing for now?
I would say it's a semi-permanent thing. I bought a house in St. John's, Newfoundland with my mom. Oh. Yeah, cause it's just we're just transcending geography right now. But I basically had this feeling of like, okay, if I'm going to leave Montreal and I'm going to live in the States, I need to have to keep some sort of connection to Canada, because if not, I'm going to become very unhealthy. I feel like I can't just like leave and never come back. And I just wanted to keep roots in Canada. And my mom had been telling me that she's planning to move to the East Coast. And I really loved St. John's. And that's where a lot of like her side of the family is from. And so we just thought, you know, why not purchase a house together and kind of put down roots in a concrete way. I basically split my time between here and St. John's.
So it's a house that you own with your mom, and like you guys are the occupants of it as well. You're not like renting it out or anything while you are away.
Yeah, exactly. Like she lives there full time. Cool. And she's kind of taken on the lion's share of renovations. Then I'll like fly in and like stay for a while and renovate too. And it's kind of.
So St. John's, for people that don't know, is like it's a really crazy cool city in Newfoundland, and it's also really hard to get to. And I've heard that there's a flight from New Jersey or something that goes in every day, and they end up turning around like over half the time because it's so foggy they can't land. Have you experienced that?
No, but I will tell you, while we were in the process of trying to purchase this house, which we officially purchased it in April, we'd like been in the process of buying it. But I was trying to fly in to sign the papers and do all the things and, you know, the inspections and stuff. And my flight was canceled from LaGuardia. My flight was canceled because, and this is not a joke, there was a fire at the airport in St. John's. And they and they just shut it down for a week. They were like, okay, whoa, you know, it was kind of like a mysterious fire and they wanted to investigate, and I totally get it. But there was just no way to get to St. John's for a full week.
That's crazy. At this point in the show, I'd like to thank our amazing sponsors for the season. We couldn't do it without their support, and this year they are Mule Resophonics. Swing wider for inspiration with Mule Resophonic guitars. These are Resophonic guitars built for acoustic guitar players. Not just blues guitars, not just slide guitars. You don't need to play them in open tunings. They're set up with normal acoustic guitar action, and they have some of the best feeling necks in the game. Trust me, they're wicked. These musical tools wake up your ear and influence your playing towards uncharted musical realms. Check out the current lineup of guitars at the Mule Store at muleresophonic.com. Thanks to Deering. Deering Banjos make some of the finest instruments out there these days and caters to all levels as well. If you're just getting into the banjo, they offer their incredible Good Time series, which are high-quality instruments at lower prices. Deering Banjos are all made in the USA, and their website also features some incredible info on their products and just general banjo information. And now Deering is also making Pro Pick finger picks and thumb picks, and that's exciting because I've been using those finger picks for years. They make these cool ones with the fingertips missing, and I love those. They're the best. You can get info on the banjos and the finger picks over at DeeringBanjos.com. Union Tube and Transistor. Union is known for guitar effects pedals with a focus on quality and simplicity. They build durable, repairable products that sound amazing both on stage and in the studio. Their fuzz effects and compression pedals are insanely cool. I use the Sonebender Fuzz, the Moore pedal, the Lab, and the Swindle Overdrive all the time in sessions and live on stage. You can find out more about them at uniontone.com. And finally, the Henhouse Hang is a three-day immersive recording experience at the Henhouse Studio in East Nashville with me, Steve Dawson. It'll be in September 2023 and then upcoming again in September of 2024. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll show you the ropes of recording roots in Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Hen House Hang. All right then, let's get back to the show. Yeah, I think...
Go ahead.
I think the American airlines have different guidelines. So what I heard, like... I've played on St. John's a bunch of times, and what I heard is like the Canadian airlines can land with quite a bit of fog, but the American airlines are not allowed to. So they'll get there, and they'll just circle and wait. And if the amount of fog doesn't subside in some way to like get beyond the level that they're allowed to land in, they have to turn around and go back.
Yeah, I believe that. So. I believe that it's a very it's an incredible place. I encourage people to visit, but it really is. It's a rock in the middle of the ocean, you know, and Cape Spear off the coast of Newfoundland is the easternmost point in North America. So, you know, it's shorter to fly from Newfoundland to Ireland than it is to fly from Newfoundland to Vancouver. How kind of wild the geography is of Canada.
Do you feel like musically, do you have some feelings to the East Coast? Like it's a strong musical thing that's developed there over a long period of time. Is that something, like you said, your mom has roots there. Is that something that you feel like as a musician that you've got to connect to the East Coast music world?
I mean, I love East Coast music and I think there's a lot of similarities between East Coast music and Appalachian music, just mm-hmm. in terms of being regions where like a lot of different like groups of people and like everything sort of it's sort of like a space where this new kind of music was born from a lot of different circumstances. Like for example, Appalachian music, as many people talk about, including Rhiannon Giddens, the banjo comes from West Africa. And so like this idea of Appalachian music being like a white music is really a myth. And I think there's a lot of that to do with East Coast music as well, especially like Mi'kmaq fiddling traditions. And so I'm really curious of learning more about it. I feel like I never did, mainly because I rarely went to the East Coast, but I think as someone who like purchased a property there, for me, it's like a way to get to know Newfoundlanders, especially, and not to just kind of be in and out. Right. And like just incredible people, like very, very funny people, very witty. I feel like there's a lot of similarities between Newfoundlanders and Irish people. And so, yeah, I'm just kind of like excited to get to know the area more. And of course, it'd be near the ocean.
It's so beautiful there.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And such a strange city as far, like just the way it's laid out and built and everything. It's so unique.
Yeah.
Love that place.
Yeah, it's great.
So let's talk a little bit about your background. Like, so, I mean, I've sort of seen you from afar, you know, growing up in the folk world, like at Folk Alliance and festivals and stuff like that around Canada. And I know, like, I know your mom from years and years of just sort of like attending those events and being part of the scene in Canada when I was growing up there. I don't live in Canada anymore, but that's, you know, I saw her around all the time. Tell me a bit about your upbringing and like how you kind of got into this music and I guess the banjo as well. Like what was the thing that drew you to the banjo instead of, I think you started on the piano, right?
Yes. And then I played a cello for years.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, so you kind of nailed it. Like my family is in kind of a musical family, and my granddad built harpsichords. And later he built acoustic guitars.
Harpsichords,
yeah.
Serious?
Yeah, serious.
Like in Canada?
Yeah, in Canada. Yeah. I can send you a link. Yeah. Yeah, his name is...
What's his, like, where is he from?
He is from Germany. So his parents actually came over to Canada after the war. And his mother was a... She was kind of like a classical music enthusiast, and so was his father. And so I think that's like kind of the role of classical music and harpsichords being a facet of that.
Wow.
And he was going to...
Was he a player too, or was he a builder?
He was a builder. Yeah, he was going to McGill for architecture. And the story goes that my grandfather, whose name is Wolfgang, talk about classical music, yeah, love. he went to the dean, and this was like the 60s in Montreal, and he just said, like, you know, I don't want to build homes. You know, I don't want to kind of be in that side of architecture. I really want to be a luthier. And I'm wondering if it's possible to just get a specialized degree and just kind of study this. And the dean, to his credit, was like, sure. And so that's kind of his divergence as a builder, just kind of focused in on musical instruments. Yeah. And so
was he building other stuff too, or just harpsichords?
I seem to remember that he built some viola da gambas, but I would have to double check. But yeah, his main instrument for years was harpsichords.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of a bizarre
thing. That's so cool.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Are they still around? Are they like Cater harpsichords or something?
Yeah, I think like a couple of them are still around. Yeah, and I actually have so he had two daughters, and I'm his only grandchild, so he built all of us guitars. So we all have like Wolfie guitars.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, just kind of like, I think just this element of like having instruments in the house and having like this like tactile access as a kid to most mm-hmm. things. It just, you know, nothing was particularly foreign to me. And whenever we would have gatherings, family gatherings, you know, everyone would sing like Joni Mitchell songs and Nitty Gritty Dirt Band songs. And it, I don't know, it just, it was very normal. And folk, the idea of folk festivals were very normal. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as any kid does, I was in the classical stream for years, but I also had this kind of parallel life where I would go to these conferences like Folk Alliance and, you know, my mom ran the Ottawa Folk Festival and the Winnipeg Folk Festival for years. And so I was able to kind of be backstage and have access to these incredible musicians, who were very kind to me, I think, as a precocious, like 12-year-old. And there was this one musician who just kind of, in the town that we lived in, he had a spare banjo and he just gave it to me. And we would go to a bluegrass festival called the Gray Fox Bluegrass Festival every year. Mm-hmm. So I started playing three finger and taking lessons, but it just didn't quite resonate. And then I befriended Mitch Podolak, who's the founder of the Winnipeg Folk Festival. Rather, he befriended me and he saw that I had a banjo. And Mitch's great, great passion in life was cooking great barbecue and teaching people how to play the banjo.
Sure was.
And so he kind of just caught me at the right age, and he sat down and gave me a lesson in clawhammer style. And he just kind of like kept following up and kept making sure that I knew that there were these opportunities to keep studying the banjo and to go to these old time camps in the States. And he set me up with a teacher in Winnipeg named Daniel Gulak.
Oh yeah, I know that guy.
Yeah. And so I think Mitch was sort of like my, like a guiding force in my life, to sort of helping me figure out where my role was with this instrument. And it was only later that I ended up seeing the Chocolate Drops and kind of learning more about the Black history of the banjo, which made me as a mixed race person feel like I kind of belonged in this tradition that for so long had felt very far from my reality.
How far did you get down the, like the Scruggs style road before you kind of realized that that wasn't a path that you were super keen on?
Not very far. I would say
okay,
maybe like 4 or 5 months.
Yeah. And you, it just didn't connect. Like it was just like a, it just felt kind of foreign and weird compared to how mm-hmm. the clawhammer.
Yeah. And frailing.
Is there a difference between clawhammer and frailing? No. Or is that the same?
They're interchangeable. Okay. You were right.
Okay.
For me, honestly, I have to say that at the time that I was learning, this was like 2006, 2007, and earlier, we would go to this bluegrass festival. But I think what I recognized was that there were a lot of Republicans at these bluegrass festivals.
Yeah.
There were, you know, it was like majority white people, a very kind of like homophobic, transphobic air mm-hmm. in the air. There was the Defense of Marriage Act, which was kind of like circling around that time. And I remember Ricky Skaggs went up on stage with his wife and kind of had this speech about, you know, this really horrible, violent
Ooh,
speech
Ricky.
about you know, keeping marriage between God and a man and a woman. So even Whoa. As a kid and like these were Bush years. And so as a kid going back and forth to America so frequently, I think like when I started learning Scruggs style, I was more confronted with the fact that I, in order to keep studying this music, I would probably
have to hang out with these people.
Yeah, exactly. Be in like pretty hostile situations, pretty uncomfortable situations. And
yeah, that doesn't feel very inspiring.
No, exactly. And I think I loved the style, but just the culture around it was just too much for me. And yeah. There was something about learning frailing or clawhammer that was honestly racially just as
homogenous, but there was, I think, more of a this kind of like liberal side that felt at least tolerable, and it felt like welcoming to me.
Were you aware of the old time scene that was happening, like in Carolina and stuff like that? That was probably a lot more friendly to what you were doing and feeling at that time, or was that so foreign that you didn't even know it existed?
I was not even aware. Only Mitch truly was my touchstone to any of that. Mm-hmm. And I think he must have recognized on some level that would be a better environment for me. And of course, like his son, Mitch's son, Leonard Podolyak, was part of a group called the Ducks, who had pretty serious success in the States and in Canada.
And so I
could observe Leonard from afar, who was in his 20s and touring at the time. And I think like just that combined picture of knowing that family, It made a lot more sense to me than kind of like learning Scruggs style next to a "Don't Tread on Me" flag, you know. Yeah. It was like, you know, they were like getting high and, you know, playing banjo and, you know, they themselves were Jewish.
Laughing their asses off.
Yeah, exactly. Laughing their asses off. And there was more of this feeling of like kind of acceptance and welcoming.
Yeah. What were some of the early... Tell me about some of the early recordings that you would have heard that would have turned you on to that kind of stuff. Like, were you going back and listening to some of the early string band stuff? Like, did you go into like the Mississippi Sheiks world at all or anything like that? Or was it specific to a certain region or anything?
Yeah, I actually ended up kind of focusing in on Round Peak style pretty early because one of my teachers was Riley Bogus. And Dirk Powell as well. And so those kind of like North Carolina, like that kind of like North Carolina. Oh, and then of course the Chocolate Drops, whose music I listened to obsessively. So I think I was more familiar with a lot of North Carolinian musicians than like Kentucky or West Virginia. And that was kind of like my entry point. And even like the first banjo camp I went to was Swannanoa, which is in Black Mountain, North Carolina, which is just outside of Asheville. That was the main thing. And then later I went to college in West Virginia. And so that was how I ended up meeting a lot more West Virginian musicians and learning a lot more about like that specific region of playing, like fiddle playing and banjo playing stuff.
How did you end up at West Virginia? Is that that place that has like a really specific string band stream of study there? Is that that?
Yeah, it's Davis and Elkins College, which is in Elkins, West Virginia. In the summer, it's the home of the Augusta Heritage Center. So basically, it's, you know, a lot of these camps in Appalachia are held on university campuses, and they have different weeks like blues week, old time week, vocal week, and I ended up I would go to a lot of these places on scholarship, just saying like, hey, I'm waitressing and I can't afford to pay the $800, you know, fee, but like I'm getting better at banjo, here's my CD, listen to it. And so I ended up applying to Augusta for a scholarship, and one of the curators there called me and told me that the school, Davis and Elkins College, was looking for full-time music students for their string band program that they were launching. So this was like 2012. I had just graduated high school, didn't know what I was doing with my life. And I ended up kind of on a lark, just driving down with my family to this college campus, and they just explained that they were recruiting young people to form a string band, and in order to like tour the string band around the area as kind of like this promotional tool for the college. I really truly think it was like this idea that the dean had, and everyone else was like, okay, let's try it. You know, he was like,
let's go for it.
Let's really put together this like emblem of like West Virginian string band music. So I ended up hanging out there for 4 years and made great friends and improved a lot.
Did you get a degree from there?
I did, but they couldn't get the string band degree program together soon enough for me to graduate. And so I ended up, they just said, you know, just study something else. And so I ended up studying religion and philosophy. But then every week I would take a string band class. And then I would also take a like a percussive dance class. So I got credits in that stream, but I think because it was such a new idea and it kind of didn't have the logistical support behind it, I wasn't able to like get a degree in string band music, which was the thing that they had originally pitched to me.
Right. Yeah. The horse was a little bit ahead of the cart, maybe.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
Tell me about what the classes were like. Were you learning banjo specific stuff or was it more ensemble based?
It was ensemble based. And we would basically prep set material to tour, and we would go on these like little tours, regional tours, with the percussive dance team. So it was like the Davis and Elkins College, you know, Appalachian String Band, and it would be like music and then percussive dance. And my teacher was Emily Miller, who she's in this band called the Sweetback Sisters, which is like a country swing band. And I credit her with just like teaching me how to sing, because I had never had any formal instruction. And she was just someone that was, you know, that was like, all right, here are the basics of like country harmony singing, you know, here's the tenor part, here's the baritone part, here, you know, here's how to figure this out, here's how to figure that out. And it was all very practical, I would say, rather than kind of like theory or composition based.
It was based around getting you guys out on the road.
Yeah. I remember I took a class with her on mic technique, which I had zero mic technique, but like she helped me start to understand what that was. Like what is sound check? She would run our sound checks. We would have no idea what we were doing, you know? And so, it was.
Yeah, sound checks are that you got to learn that shit somehow.
Yeah, exactly. So it was like a ton of practical instruction, and I'm grateful for that now. I think what suffered really was like theory, you know, like written notation was something that I never really learned until the last couple of years when I started taking composition classes. And so like that stuff, it was a little patchy, but I will definitely say that like my singing, my performance skill set just grew exponentially. Yeah.
That's so cool and crazy. So you were there for 4 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Were you taking any private banjo instruction or was it all just based around this class, the performance class?
I did take private banjo instruction from a man named Andy Fitzgibbon, who is an incredible banjo player, is not a music professional. He's a farmer. And he'll go around to all the regional banjo and fiddle contests, and he'll just clean up. Like he'll just play, like enter the banjo contest, win $1,000, enter the fiddle contest, win $1,000. He's just an incredibly talented musician. And so I requested to have my lessons with him, and he's a very quiet person. And so I just felt like I was like sitting at the feet of this, you know, this like quiet old time musician and just trying to absorb whatever he was willing to teach.
And he had like all the traditional tunes and styles down.
Yes, down. Like, and I believe we didn't even scratch the surface of everything that he knew. I could go back for another year easily and still be learning from him.
How much traditional stuff did you actually get your head around? Like, how deep did you go down that? It sounds like, I guess, the ensemble you were in was playing pretty much straight up trad stuff. But, like, could you do a whole set of traditional music right now if you needed to?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could? Mm-hmm. Okay. So you know all that. You know all that stuff.
Yeah.
Because you, like, I know you and most people know you as an original songwriter. And you've used the banjo as a tool to create your own music. But, you know, I don't know you as a traditional player. So that's interesting.
Yeah, actually, I was kind of thinking like after this record, it would be really fun to make a record of traditional music. And I think it was quite intentional for me. I was always like, oh, I want to be a songwriter. Like, that was my goal since before I had learned the banjo. So the banjo just became a tool on that journey. But yeah, traditional.
Were you writing songs at the same time as going when you were going to Elkins? Was that something you were doing as
well?
Yeah,
writing songs and putting out records. Mm-hmm. I think I just always learned by doing it. By just trying to do it. And I was lucky enough to have enough of a support system that was possible for me, which is not the mm-hmm. reality for many people. So I learned like a ton of ballad singing. Like I could sing you endless like traditional ballads.
Wicked.
And actually I take great inspiration from a lot of the imagery in a lot of those old songs.
I know what you mean, for sure. Where would you point people to recorded music that you found really inspirational as far as like traditional string band or black banjo players? Or I don't know, like what are some unusual things that you've stumbled across that you find have really influenced your path on the banjo and music in general?
I would encourage people to check out recordings by the Hammonds family. They were just a group of people with, you know, some were fiddle players. Maggie Hammonds was an incredible ballad singer. And I think collectively the amount of music that they, the amount of like the long memories that they had and the stuff that they were pulling out is just brilliant and incredible. And I would just play their music over and over and over. I don't think you can find them on Spotify. It's weird. I mean, they have.
Where do you find that stuff? Do you have to get it on 78 or something?
I think you can. I think you can order it from the Smithsonian. I think you can also go on and stream some of it. It's definitely. I'll double check, but it's definitely not something that you can just pull up very easily. But they were a huge influence on me. And, you know,
what about on the banjo specifically?
I would say there weren't a ton of older recordings of the banjo that I was particularly inspired by, mostly because a lot of the time I was just bothered by how out of tune the banjo sounded. And so I was like, I can't get into this tune. It's too pitchy.
Did you ever get into like Doc Boggs or Roscoe Holcomb or any of that kind of stuff? Or was that not really your jam?
I mean, I did and I would listen to it, but I don't think I'd be like, oh my God, let me learn this. I really got into Snake Chapman.
Okay.
I love his tunes. And obviously Snake Chapman's
I don't know him.
He's great. You got to check him out.
Really?
Yeah. He's a fiddle player, but just an incredibly talented, like detail oriented fiddle player. And so I like lately I've just been learning all his fiddle tunes on the banjo. And so that's kind of like more the bent that I would take is listening to older fiddle players. And then obviously I'm a huge fan of Adam Hurt and, you know, Sam Amidon. I'm just really fans of people who kind of have a bit of an oddball approach to playing the instrument.
Label wise, are you still on, did you say Folkways or did you say... you were on Folkways before. Are you still on Folkways now?
No, I'm kind of shopping the album around, so I'm label-less as of now.
Okay, so tell me about this. You mentioned before, I just want to jump back to it, the Folkways, like the archive thing that you were able to dig into a little bit, especially the Grenadian traditional side of things. So is that like a building? I don't even know what it is. Is it a building that has a huge archive?
That's exactly it. Yeah, it's a building that has a massive archive.
And it's in D.C.?
It's in D.C. Mm-hmm.
And it's part of the Smithsonian?
Yeah, and honestly, Steve, you could probably get a tour of it if you just emailed them.
What is it exactly? It's a massive building full of records. Has it been digitized? Is it cataloged? Like, are you just randomly walking the aisles looking at crazy shit? Like,
no.
What is it actually like?
So there's a side of the Smithsonian building that it is a record label. So there's like, you know, people kind of like working on
it is like inventory and stuff. And then there's the archival side, and everything has been digitized. So there's a way to look in the system and go, okay, I want to, you know, put in the keywords, and then it'll show you like you can find X thing here, and then you can go in and pull it out. I seem to recall that they asked me, like, I couldn't take anything out of the room that it was in.
Okay.
I could record on my phone. So I ended up putting on these records and then just like turning on voice memos and like recording what I heard. And that's what I took home. And looked over.
Are you allowed to do that? Or are you actually not supposed to be doing that?
I don't remember. I think they probably told me not to do that, but now I've said it and I've done it. Yeah. But they've been cool about it. And there are these like incredible things, like there are letters from, it's not only records, it's like there's letters from Lead Belly. There's like just incredible stuff that you can go and check out, but I think you need a folklorist to take you through, because if you're just walking through the aisles, it's just, you know, it's all temperature controlled and everything's in its place, and it's hard to tell what's in what box. So that's why a tour is really cool, because they can like pull stuff out and show it to you. It's really amazing. Like, I recommend the tour to every musician who goes through DC.
So being on the label, they sort of opened that up to you and just said, have at it, check it out.
Yeah. And I think that lately they've been on this kind of mission to make those things more accessible, especially to like working musicians. Because for so long, Smithsonian was basically kind of like administering the records and estates of dead people. And so it has a bit of a museum feel, but like in the last six-ish years, they've really just been wanting people to come in and learn and especially like working touring musicians.
So what kind of crazy Grenadian stuff did you find musically? Like, was there big surprises there, or was it overwhelming, or was there kind of a finite collection, or what was the general feeling that you got from checking that section out?
It was a pretty finite collection. I think mostly just because Grenada is such a small island compared to the other Caribbean islands. But there was the Emery Cook collection. He was a folklorist, and he went to Grenada and spent quite a lot of time there and made a whole record. And what it sounded like when I was listening to it and making illegal voice memos was that he basically had put a mic down, and you could hear like roosters and dogs and like just typical sounds of the Caribbean. And it seemed like he was pretty hands off. And so he would ask people to come up to the mic if they had a song. And then everyone else was standing around because it was like such a cool thing to have this white man with a microphone in their town.
Yeah.
And so they would like sing, very generously sing, and everyone would join in on the refrains. And so it was like a lot of songs that people knew. There was some like French kind of stuff happening, because before Grenada was a British colony, it was a French colony. So there are some kind of like French language roots there. And that was cool to hear. This recording would have been from like the early 50s.
What about instrumentally? Was there guitars and fiddles and banjos and stuff, or not? Or
no,
what was going on?
Not really. It was a lot more kind of like vocal, choral, call and response stuff than I thought there would be. And actually, I've learned recently that the banjo is far more prominent in American folk music than it is in Caribbean folk music, for a multitude of reasons. But in the States, drums were banned from plantations because white slave owners figured out that black folks were talking to each other, like the talking drum, were communicating with each other through drumming. And that was something that that like the European slave owners in
the states figured out and banned, but in the Caribbean, they were never banned. So in Caribbean, like if you think of like so many of the like the musical cultures revolve around like steel pan and drumming, mm-hmm. Versus like in the States, it's a lot more like guitar, banjo, anything that's portable stringed instrument, which, you know, white people, having European sensibilities didn't find to be as threatening. So I would say in the Caribbean, like I brought my banjo and a lot of people were like, oh, cool. Like this is great, but it's not really cemented as part of the culture. Thing. Yeah.
When you were there, like creating and writing and just sort of discovering things when you went there, were you received positively? Like, were people receptive to that and like thought it was interesting what you were doing? Or did they just sort of leave you alone and let you do your thing? Or how did that all go down?
People were really interested. I ended up sitting in on a music class at the local university because word got back to this professor that I was in town. And it's such a small community. Everyone knows each other. And so it was a really cool thing to just kind of drop into this music class. And I think with Grenadians, and I think this applies to a lot of the Caribbean, so much of the Grenadian population is outside of Grenada, is like here in Brooklyn or in Canada or in England, that there's this strong sense that when you come back, you're like one of us who's come home. And so I felt a lot more acceptance than I thought I would as someone who felt like just so thoroughly Canadian. I felt like this kind of thing of like, oh yeah, you've just come back and that's great. And like, I know your dad and I know your uncle and I know your grandpa. And you know, there's like this, so they're like, oh, you're this, like you're from this family. Okay, cool. And they kind of like know where to place you. And so it just felt very normal.
Did your dad go back ever?
Yeah, he went back several times. He had to wait until he got his permanent residency status. And I think he got that in like 93, 94. And then
in Canada.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
As he was like applying for refugee status, he couldn't leave the country. So when he finally got it, he would go back all the time. And I went back with him when I was younger, but there was a chunk of time where I didn't go back. And he actually, he was gifted some land. So he has always, always, always planned on retiring to Grenada. Like he will never die here in Canada, I mean. It's really like, and that's what a lot of Grenadians do, is you spend your working life making as much money as you can, get your pension, and then go back and live the rest of your life in the Caribbean.
Okay, interesting.
So yeah. Wow. And I'm going back in August. So I've been going back regularly. Yeah.
Okay. So you do have other family and stuff there too, like extended family beyond your dad?
Yeah, I have many, many uncles and aunts.
Yeah.
My grandfather was there. He passed away in 2018. And my grandmother too. Yeah, I'm taking her to the doctor when I go home.
Oh, wow.
When I go back to Grenada. So yeah, it's like most of my family is there still. Yeah.
And so you're putting out this record at some point, December, January, February, March, something like that. And are you going to be touring a bunch? Like, what's your thing with touring? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Where are you at?
I used to hate it, growing to love it.
Okay.
Yeah. I would love to know what your touring opinions are.
I have a love-hate relationship with touring. I enjoy it. When I do it as my own project with my own band, I find it very fun and very stressful at the same time. And, you know, I'm sort of a one person operation as far as like organizing things and stuff. I don't have a big support system. So it's a lot of work. And then if I go out as a side person to somebody, whether it was, you know, for a few years, it was like all Birds of Chicago. And then it was with Matt Anderson as well. And so I was doing a ton of touring and I probably did too much at that point because I mean, Birds of Chicago was like 150 dates a year probably. And Matt was another 50 or 60 that year. That was just before COVID. So I don't know. I got a little fried on the whole thing. I like it though, sort of. I don't know. For me, like if I'm at home working in the studio, I can spend 8 or 10 hours on music and feel great. When I'm on the road, it's like I get to play the gig and the rest of the day is kind of shot with like annoying travel problems.
Totally. Yeah.
I don't know. So that's why I really hate it. You know, it's like dealing with getting on an airplane is so shitty that it's stressful and it kind of blows your day. So I don't know. If I can stay home and be in the studio and mix a song, I feel kind of more productive, you know?
When did you move to Nashville?
10 years ago.
Okay. What brought you to Nashville?
I just wanted to get out of Vancouver and have a change of scenery. And I thought Nashville seemed like a cool place to go.
I feel like it was quite prescient of you. I feel like there are more and more folks are songwriters who are moving to Nashville, musicians.
Yeah, it's crazy here. You know, like it's really booming and it's gotten way over the point where it's like an affordable, escapee kind of place that, you know, people were, you know, you were able to, when I moved here, you were able to come here and buy a house for cheap and stuff. And that's just gone, completely gone now. So it's not the same at all, but it's still a pretty great place. And it's still a music town with a lot going on other than, you know, I'm not involved in the new country world at all. I ignore it and it ignores me. So it's a good relationship. But aside from that, there's a ton of great stuff going on and great musicians. And I've got a little scene of people here that I work with a lot and it's good. Do you have a set band that you always tour with?
No, I mean, let's see. I toured with my partner, Andrew. We toured as a duo for a long time. And that's actually how we got together. Was I hired him for a gig and, you know, for some reason that tour was very romantic and we ended up, you know, whatever. Yeah. So I feel a lot of the time, like my band is very kind of like it sizes up or down depending on the kind of money that I'm offered. So, basically when I need to make a little bit more money on the road, I'll just tour solo.
You do some solo stuff.
Yeah. And then when it would be really fun or if it's a record release year, I'll size up the band. And I just really love playing with just kind people. I think I've let go of, you know, musicians who are, I think like maybe a little prickly, but great musicians. I think I've learned the hard way that it doesn't matter how great of a musician you are. If you can't kind of get along with people, it just...
The prickly part is what sticks with
you.
Yeah,
it's just a little tough to make that work. Yeah. So
it's all about the hang.
Exactly. So I just tour with really kind people that I like to hang with and whose music I admire. Yeah. And that's kind of been my goal. And I think with Strange Medicine, I'll probably, like I said, take a little bit more of a jazz approach. So maybe hire like a saxophonist or and like a drummer and kind of present the record that way.
Well, I wish you luck with all that stuff and looking forward to when the record comes out. And thanks for talking to me today about all this stuff. It's really interesting.
Thanks for having me on, Steve. As Tim O'Brien says, see you down that lonesome road.
Yes, indeed.
Cool. Well, thank you for taking the time too. It means a lot. And it was great to just like chat. Felt like such a relaxed conversation. So thanks.
That's what we go for here.
Sweet. Okay, cool.
All right.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, you too. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening, everybody. Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast is produced at the Hen House Studio in East Nashville, Tennessee. Please remember to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist for Spotify and Apple Music at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thank you again to our sponsors this season, Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra in 1964, The Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resonator Guitars, and The Henhouse Hang. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. Over and out.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.